The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, 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 all persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning. We are happy to hear argument in Dushada versus Providence Dane and Mr. Francis.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Ernest Francis, appearing on behalf of Harold Dushada. This case presents three issues. The first is that of the appellee's suggestion of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I only mention this out of deference to the principle that each court has an obligation to examine its own subject matter jurisdiction. I submit that the suggestion as to lack of jurisdiction is not substantial. The district court held that we had stated the elements of a claim under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and I believe that resolves the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. The second issue on which I will spend most of the balance of my time is what on its face would appear to be the narrow procedural issue of how does a plaintiff under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act make a prima facie showing of a consumer debt. And I would note that this is an issue of tremendous practical as well as legal significance. It's very significant for, in light of the recent phenomenon of debt buying, which is what we have in this case. More importantly, the legal significance is that what the appellee is trying to do under the guise of an evidentiary requirement is to undo the holding, which is universal everywhere, that a plaintiff, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act need not owe the debt to have a cause of action under that statute. What I would note is that this case presents a tension between two established provisions of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The first is that there must be a consumer debt for the Act to apply. The second, as I noted a moment ago, is that the Act applies even when the plaintiff does not owe the debt and therefore cannot show the purpose of the debt if he does not owe it. Again, what the appellee's approach would do and what the appellee is arguing is that unless a party against whom the debt collector seeks to recover on credit cards can show the purpose of the charges to those cards, there's no consumer debt, and therefore
are you
there's
pretending that this is not your debt at all.
My client didn't remember,
regardless of the nature of it.
My client didn't remember having made the charges that were alleged as due on the card.
But it seems a little disingenuous, isn't it? Because it has the billing statement and charges had the name and address of your client on them.
That's correct. And I would submit
and
that
you just say, well, I don't remember. How did the name and address of your client get on them?
Okay. What I would note and what I think is significant in that respect is that out of the $20,000 that was allegedly due on two cards, on one card they cannot identify a single charge on that card. They can't identify anything that my client put on that card.
I thought you already got out from under the debt.
We did in the circuit court for
Fairfax. You went to state court and prevailed and got out from under all of it.
That's correct.
So what? Then you sued in federal court because you were upset with the conduct.
We sued in federal court, and I think we had 18.
So you aren't here. You can't be trying to defeat the debt because you're already out from under it.
The debt has already been resolved. That's correct. And the essence of the federal court action.
But over here, you have to prove you had a debt to prevail, right?
We had to prove that
you had consumer debt. Which you're already out from under.
We have to prove there's a consumer debt, yes. But the statute provides in the definitional section 1692A5 that a debt is what is owed or allegedly owed. So again, the universal holding.
Okay, the magistrate judge pointed to the fact that you bear the burden of indicating that this is showing that this is a consumer debt rather than a commercial debt. And then the magistrate judge says, look, this isn't a high bar in any way, shape, or form. Could you just give me something beyond these billing statements and charges that gives me a clue to the nature of the debt? And it gave you a lot of different chances to do that. And he said, look, he almost pleaded with you, said this is not a high bar, but some of these charges are ambiguous because restaurant bills can be used for personal or business reasons. People deduct those things all the time because they're business expenses. And computer purchases could be for personal reasons or they could be for office equipment. And could you just tell me a little bit about it? And so, you know, the question I have for you is, he did seem to give you a chance over and over again to just move beyond the bare billing statements and statement of charges and say, just show me that these are primarily for personal use, and that's fine, and we'll move on from there. But you didn't seem to sort of take up on that invitation. And you know, the magistrate judge was not unsympathetic to your case. He was begging you almost to come forward with it and just give him a little something.
Your Honor, we cannot show what the purpose of the charges on the card were.
Then you can't prove your case. Well, isn't that the problem?
No.
You're seeking affirmative relief. You're not defending against a debt. You're asking for affirmative relief here. And you have to prove your case, don't you? So what basis would there be for us to say that you don't have to prove the elements of your cause of action?
That's not what I'm asking. What I'm arguing is that, as in the cases of Hansen and Hepson, upon which we place principal reliance, the fact that we can't identify the charges on the card does not mean that we can't satisfy the burden of showing, to the extent we have that burden, the burden of showing a consumer debt.
What have you done to show that debt?
Okay. First, we submit that the debt collector sent a letter to my client saying federal law requires us to advise that this communication is an attempt by a debt collector to collect a debt.
Right, but that could go either way, because the debt collector could be just trying to, they could be sending out just a boilerplate statement to cover their, you know, their back every time that they send out a letter. I mean, that doesn't establish the nature of the debt. It might be circumstantial evidence that you could point to, but it certainly doesn't establish of itself. So what else do you have?
Well, I would note in that connection
that if we took you up on that point, we'd be saying that every time that a debt collector took an extra precautionary measure to try to comply with the act, it was doing itself in, and it would be counterproductive, because then people would say, wait, when we try to comply with the act, they use it against us. So that's not a good idea.
Your Honor, that's not what would follow from using that in this case, because what they did was they did not merely comply with the act. They went beyond what the act requires. The act doesn't require them to say federal law requires. The act requires, and this is 1692E11, the act requires specific language in that section. They went beyond that language. So this is not merely an attempt to include what the statute.
So why would we penalize them for going beyond the bare minimum?
Well, because they used language which we believe was can be construed as an admission, because the only statute that would require them to include that language is the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And if the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, as they've stated here, requires them to include that language, then that presupposes that there is a consumer.
No, because then every, as Judge Keenan said, then every time anyone takes a protective action to, as Judge Keenan puts it, cover their back in an effort to comply with federal law, then they're, the way you would have it, that would be tantamount to an admission that they're covered by the law. And I don't think that is necessarily a good idea, or that it's correct. Okay. But what else do you have?
Yes. The second approach we used was that adopted by the 11th Circuit in Hepson, which is that of circumstantial evidence. And in Hepson, what the court had before it was a statement that was sent to the debtor's residential address. The debt was in the debtor's name, and the debtor had denied a business purpose for the debt. We followed that approach here. The debt was allegedly that of my client. It was sent, the statements that they had, and again, they cover a minuscule part of the alleged debt, were sent to my client's address. And my client had, in his declaration, stated that he had never used any credit card for a business purpose or for the purpose of engaging in a transaction for profit. So we had exactly what they had in Hepson, and the 11th Circuit held that that circumstantial evidence was sufficient to show a consumer debt. And again, the consumer in Hepson could not state the purpose of the charges in that case, much like my client can't. And I would note that if we have to identify the purpose of the charges, we need to consider exactly who that is going to eliminate from the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
You wouldn't have to identify all the charges, just a couple of them. But I didn't, as I understand it, you didn't really identify even one, not one item. I mean, well, you don't have to. I don't think anybody's saying you have to go through a statement of 20 charges and identify every one of them. But maybe you need to identify, if not every one of them, at least one item, or two, or whatever.
But we're in the same position as victims of identity theft, victims of unauthorized use of a credit card, those who are subjected to a suit to collect zombie debt.
But none of that happened here. That's not arguably an issue.
None of it happened. But if the principle that the appellee once adopted is in fact adopted, those plaintiffs will be outside of the FDCPA because they can't identify any of the purposes of the charges for which the debt collector would seek to recover. I would note that in the case of Chowdhury versus Galarizo, the court noted that the purpose of the verification provision was to prevent an attempt by the debt collector from collecting a debt from somebody who didn't know it, a case of mistaken identity. That person is going to be outside of the FDCPA, because if you have a debt collector that's attempting to collect a debt from John Q. Public and the real debtor is John R. Public, John Q. Public, the putative debtor from whom the debt collection efforts are directed, is not going to know what any of the charges are for. So what the court identified as the right in Galarizo is essentially meaningless because the act wouldn't apply because the consumer couldn't identify the purpose of the charges since he didn't make them. I see I have about a minute left. I would like briefly to turn to the third issue that we raised, which is that of whether Twombly and Iqbal apply to defensive pleadings of affirmative defenses. The majority rule in this circuit is that they do. So what is not acceptable for a plaintiff's pleading would not be acceptable for a defendant's pleading. And they had four defenses that we moved to strike under Rule 12F. One was the bona fide error defense. They pled no facts to that. The second was acts or omissions of a third party for which they're not responsible. They never specified what acts, by whom, other than the parties that they did mention who they said were not the exclusive parties. And then they never said why they weren't responsible. They then talked about conduct that does not exemplify abusive or unfair behavior, according to the intent of Congress. But that issue had already been decided in connection with the dismissal for failure, or motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. I see my time has expired. I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Ash?
Good morning. I'm David Ash. I'm general counsel for Providence Dane, the appellee. It is an honor to present oral argument to the appellate court. The principal means by which appellant seeks relief is the concept of admission. But there can be no admission without knowledge. What is the ability or means by which a debt collector could obtain knowledge about how a debtor used his credit card? What is the means by which the original creditor could obtain knowledge about how the credit card was used and then later admit that knowledge? There are no means. Now, the only means is if the debtor himself can provide information. However, that is the core of this case. In sworn statement after sworn statement, Mr. Busada has said, I don't know, I don't recall. Any time we asked him, have you held the card? Have you seen the card? Did you make a purchase with it? Did you make a payment on it? Have you ever seen a billing statement from Chase?
Are you referring to some deposition he gave?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not referring to the trial testimony at the,
actually, there
in
were
the
some,
state court?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are? You're referring to trial testimony and depositions?
And also his responses to written interrogatories.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. So I say at a minimum three instances of sworn statements that he doesn't have that knowledge. And that's why where summary judgment is appropriate when there's no dispute over a genuine fact, this is a lack of dispute. This is
a
vacuum.
When you send a statement of charges to a single individual, not a company or whatever, would there be some sort of presumption that that is a personal that's a consumer debt? I mean, I would think that the vast number of credit card statements, they go out and the name up at the top is an individual. And then I guess was this address Mr. Bouchard's home address?
Yes, Your Honor. The question was...
When a card goes out with the name of an individual and lists his home address, would there be some sort of a presumption in that instance, given the fact that the overwhelming majority of those statements are sent?
There could be no such presumption.
Why not?
Well, business debts often are backed by a personal guarantee. Say a solo lawyer who signs a lease for office space and also signs a personal guarantee, or for financing for his business, will sign a personal guarantee to that business expense. In addition, as the court has already noted out and the district court pointed out, expenses on a credit card for gas and groceries could be a business expense, a cake for the office, gas for a company vehicle, what have you. And that's one of the means by which he seeks to state that there's been admission, the fact that they tried to collect from him personally. In fact, appellant counsel also mentioned that he principally relies upon the Hepson case and the Hansen case. The Hepson case does not control the 11th Circuit. It does not have a following. It offered no analysis. I have the Hepson case here. It's about 8 pages, single space printed out. Nothing's mentioned in the body of the opinion. The final footnote says, well, they did try to collect from him personally, and it was never raised. There's nothing else on the record, so we're just going to say it applies to FDCPA. There was no analysis, as the court is engaging in here and as the district court did. He also mentions the Hansen case. In the Hansen case, everyone knew everything about that debt. It was a parking ticket. There had been payments made on the debt. They acknowledged he wasn't sure what the nature of the parking ticket was about. That was what was at issue. So there's nothing in Hansen or Hepson to provide here.
What were the nature of the charges here?
We provided about a year and a half worth of charges, and the charges that I saw were I saw a grocery store a couple times. There were I believe there's
would a grocery store purchase be a business expense?
Absolutely could be. I could buy a cake for the office. I could be going to get something if my industry is related to food service. I could be.
Is that likely?
I think the court could take judicial notice that is done frequently.
What did the plaintiff do for a living?
He, at the time of the last deposition, not working, but had been in various sales positions that he mentioned.
If he wasn't working, it would be highly unlikely he'd be using it for a commercial purpose.
I'm not sure there's anything in the record that provides that.
You just told me he wasn't working.
He, at the time of the last deposition, I remember asking.
What was he doing at the time the debts were incurred?
I could check the record, but I'm not sure. But I think what I'd like to say also is that we're now engaged in the speculation that wouldn't have to take place if we had any information to rely upon.
Your point, I guess, is that he bears the burden on us.
Absolutely.
And you didn't know. Your records didn't show.
Exactly.
What,
I think
you're working for the credit card company, and they didn't give you the information.
I'm a salaried employee of the debt collector. And
you're the counsel to the debt collector.
Yes, sir.
You're representing the debt collector here.
Yes,
when
sir.
I say you, I mean the debt collector.
Yes.
You're working for the credit card, the bank,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
The bank doesn't supply you the information as to what the debt's about?
Oh, they provide the billing statement, which is all that anyone does.
They provided you the billing statement.
That's right. That just show what he charged for. But
the billing statement's here. They were only like $250 out of the 20-some thousand that were, y'all could say what they were, which ones you went to the grocery store or the service station or things like that.
What was
the other 20,000 or 22,000?
Unknown, Your Honor. And anything we would look at.
The billing statements didn't say? I mean, did he buy refrigerators or cars or anything on them?
We have not looked at the other billing statements.
Was he flying on airplanes?
I've never seen the other billing statements. We had about a year and a half worth, which is what we had on hand. There was no request for additional.
Did your client give them to you?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, we didn't because we thought it would have been cumulative to show years and years.
One of the things is you don't want the debt collector to know too much about the consumer's personal life. I don't fault the bank for not giving you detailed statements like he went to the grocery store to purchase for his family because that would be a real intrusion into a person's privacy. So I'm sympathetic to that aspect of it, that banks aren't in possession of a lot of information on this stuff, and we don't want them to be.
Yes, Your Honor. And also, if I was engaged in speculating about what the purchase is for, I hope there would be a strong objection from the other side saying, I don't want to hear from the debt collector about how my client used these cards.
Let me ask you this. What reason do you have to believe these might be business debts?
We do not have information either way. This is a vacuum.
Do you have any reason at all to suspect that these might be business purchases?
Yes, Your Honor, simply because this is our industry, and when I look at charges, I know that it's an unknown. Cakes, gas, grocery could be for any expense. Also, I know that when we try to collect on someone personally, we do collect commercial debts, and often these are just normal credit cards used for various things, but it was for a business, and then it's backed by a personal guarantee, which is why we tried to collect personally. But again, it would, for us to speculate, now we're providing evidence for his claim. He wants to sue. He wants to sue for money and damages.
Well, that's really why you don't want to know more, right? I don't think it's you're really not protecting the privacy of the person, or the bank's not. It's just that if you don't know, they can't establish their claim through you.
I understand what you're saying.
I'm not saying that's wrong. Oh, I'm just saying it isn't, practically speaking, that's what we're talking about. Why should you help them make their case?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be irrelevant. We do not actively avoid learning. It's irrelevant for us to study a 15-year life cycle credit card when we can look at about a year's worth and say, you know, because when we provide credit, billing statements, we're trying to say, does this give you some peace of mind that this is your debt, that's your address, that's your name? That's the purpose of providing. For us to analyze the purchases, I hope anyone would object.
Do you know over what period of time do they give you information like to show you over what period of time this debt was accumulated?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. We know the opening date.
So you know whether it was built up in 6 months or 15 years?
Yes, Your Honor. This was a credit card open for at least 10 years.
Okay. But do you know when the debt was built up? It could be if it was open for 10 years. I mean, I might pay mine for 9.5 and then run up a big bill for the last 6 months.
Certainly, Your Honor. I could speculate like
that. If they pay that, then they get you out.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I could speculate like that.
But you don't know.
We do not know. And I'd like to say this about that.
You don't ask them that?
No. No. I think what we ask, like to ask debtors is, you know, can you work with us? Can we come to a payment arrangement?
I'm talking about that. You don't ask your client, bank, that. When did they accumulate this debt? Was it the last 6 months or was it the last 10 years?
I would never
make that kind of inquiry either.
I would never ask that because...
Do you know how much of this $20,000 or whatever it was penalties or interest as opposed to actual purchases or costs for purchasing whatever was purchased?
Within the billing statements, we can answer that question.
The billing statements you have.
What we have.
What about for the aggregate amount?
No, Your Honor. I would never ask unless the plaintiff trying to sue us.
How is interest and penalties characterized as between commercial and consumer? Does it follow whatever the purchase was?
That's a good question. Most likely it would be characterized as whatever else is on the billing statements because within the terms and conditions of a credit card, your interest and penalties become principal. That's my best answer there.
One aspect of your case that I am sympathetic to is you're thinking, well, should we send out a fair debt collection practices notice? And in this case, you know, as a protective measure, I suppose you did. But just from a privacy standpoint, I'm not sure I want you sleuthing around into the nature of an individual's purchases in order to decide whether you are or are not covered by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It does strike me that having you doing that kind of sleuthing on the front end does raise serious questions of consumer privacy. And I think it's better from a privacy standpoint to have the consumer, after bringing suit, voluntarily bring that information forward as an element of his or her claim. But there's a privacy dimension of it here as to when this information gets divulged. I'm not sure I want banks or credit card companies looking into people's personal finances to decide whether or not they're covered. I suspect it's okay to just send a protective notice cover yourself.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, a few other courts have looked at it that way, to say putting the mini Miranda, as we call it, that says this is from a debt collector. That is a prophylactic approach for the safety of the debt collectors, as Judge Keenan pointed out. But also,
it's fair to say that that's an admission.
Well, indeed, Your Honor, because admission, again, can only come from knowledge. We don't have that knowledge. There's no way we could get that knowledge. In fact, that's why this case really, it calls on the carpet one of the voir dire questions that lawyers like to ask juries, where we say, ladies and gentlemen, the burdens are so powerful that if the defendant shows up and doesn't say a word, he might win, he might lose. If the prosecutor shows up and doesn't say a word, he absolutely loses because he must bring evidence. And that's where nothing has been brought. It's not our burden to provide this information for his critical case. But also,
I don't mean to cut you off here, but how do you respond to Mr. Francis's argument that a victim of identity theft then would have no remedy under the Act? Do you agree with him on that?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to make sure I had time for that. Fortunately, Congress thought about this issue long before appellant's case. Congressman Frank Annunzio in 1977 worked years to pass the FDCPA, and he built in the verification process. When the debt collector first makes contact with the debtor, we say, you have a right to dispute this. Let us know if you dispute this. Is this an invalid debt? Because if you don't dispute this, we can assume it's a valid debt. And so under the scenario that Congress laid out, in a situation like Mr. Busada, he could have, and he acknowledged that he doesn't know why he didn't respond to our letter that said, tell us if you dispute. Under Congress's scenario, the debtor says, who are you people? I don't recall this debt. Under the scenario that appellant would like, if he prevails, then the debtor can watch letters and communications come in from a debt collector until they hit critical mass, and then he can say, you know, I've been meaning to tell you all, I'm not the actual guy. This is identity theft. But I'd also like to say, what are the procedures in place that any collector could have to learn of that information? Many times, it would be the debtor himself who doesn't know identity theft happened until a debt collector says, you owe money on this card. And then the debtor can say, I don't know, let me look into this. But instead, we had Mr. Busada's position, which they want here, is for the debtor to be able to watch the communications come in. Congress built in that verification process to avoid this. That's why we'd like to follow the statute.
How often do these suits arise after the debt has been paid? Or do they generally arise in conjunction with an action to recover on the, or do they arise as a defensively in an action to recover on the debt, or do they arise as part of the same litigation? I mean, how often does it unfold in this way where the debt has actually been resolved and everything and then as a separate in federal court? Is this typical or is this a bit unusual?
Most of the time, it's a counterclaim while the question action is ongoing. In this case, appellant counsel brought TILA and usury claims against us in state court. That way, he was still free to come back to federal court.
Was this ever raised as a counterclaim in state court?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And the jury deliberated and found against Mr. Busada for that claim. And
is there a preclusion question here?
I looked at that, Your Honor. I did not raise it simply because we're going from state to federal. He sued on TILA and usury, and now he's suing on Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Bring all claims when they're ripe. I do agree, Your Honor.
But historically, what happened, you brought suit in state court, and you had a trial.
That's right. We brought
And he prevailed.
No, Your Honor.
What happened?
We brought a collection action in Fairfax County Circuit Court in Virginia. And suing to get a judgment on the debt, they counterclaimed, alleging that we had violated TILA and usury laws. And the jury deliberated on the counterclaims and found for us.
And what happened to your claim?
Oh, we did not get our judgment. We attempted to authenticate the billing statements.
So both of you lost?
That's correct.
That's what I was getting at.
That is correct.
All right. But he's out. Does that mean he's out from under the debt?
Yes. The debt exists. However, legal means of trying to collect it is over. That's been decided. No one can sue. I suppose someone could give him a call and say, would you like to pay this?
You got a judgment on the collection effort.
Right. There's no judgment for a collection.
You won on the counterclaim.
That's right. So everybody walked away with nothing. He didn't have to pay a $20,000 credit card. We didn't have to pay for his allegations that we violated law. I see that I've got about 3.5 minutes left. And I would like to also mention...
These claims have been litigated in that proceeding in Fairfax County?
No, Your Honor. None of these claims.
They're exclusively in federal court?
That is correct. The FDCPA claims, TILA and usury, were in the state court.
Well, couldn't the FDCPA claim have been part of the counterclaim in state court?
Absolutely. You can go to state or federal for FDCPA.
If it could have been raised...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
If it could have been raised, is it subject to a preclusive bar?
I did not raise that, but I welcome the court's questions on that subject. I do feel...
The judicata applies not only to things that were raised. You keep saying, well, he raised usury claims and TILA claims. But res judicata obviously applies to claims that should have and could have been raised and weren't, because there is a question here about why we're having two lawsuits in this kind of matter when the whole thing could have been resolved in one. Raises a question in my mind is whether we are indulging in a kind of litigation sprawl, because would have been no bar to raising the FDCPA as a counterclaim in the state court action, would there? I mean, there's concurrent jurisdiction.
Your Honor, a lot of the FDCPA claims that he brought to federal court alleged that my conduct in the state court trial violated fair debt. For instance, my witness list was five days late, and he alleged this was a violation.
Isn't there concurrent jurisdiction in FDCPA matters? I mean, normally the presumption is, unless Congress provides for exclusive federal jurisdiction, that the jurisdiction is concurrent, presumptively concurrent.
I would agree, Your Honor. There's a lot of risk in fair debt litigation. Attorney's fees and demands get very high. Sometimes we don't litigate a particular issue or motion unless we feel very certain, because the risk to us is so enormous on attorney's fees and cost shifting. And I have a minute and a half.
I just don't understand why, if there was a bar to bringing that up along with the usury and FOTILA claims. He raised one federal question with FOTILA.
I welcome the court's questions on that, and I can only say that part of his lawsuit in federal district court alleged that my conduct at the state court trial violated FDCPA. Perhaps he was going to claim that my conduct then generated the new claims. For instance, my witness list was late, and that was a violation of fair debt deadline type issues.
Well, I just
like
wonder,
that.
You know, whether what interest all this is serving when we have two lawsuits and something that could have been done is one. It's a higher, you know, there are higher fees for everybody involved. There are transaction costs that are loaded onto the system. There are delays in getting things resolved. You always worry about things taking on a certain bleak house quality. Not that this has reached that level, but...
Oh, especially with identity theft, which was never raised before. He's sort of asking for an advisory opinion. And if I just also like to mention the balance of my time, that there was an affidavit that was late filed. The affidavit, which he says is an unsworn declaration, certainly does not state anything about the debt at issue. It simply says, I'd like to tell you about debts that I've been involved with that may or may not have been business debts. I just want to mention about the untimely affidavit that was at play. And I see that I believe my time is up right now.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would like to address several points that the appellee raised.
Why don't you tell us why this thing wasn't litigated in state court?
There were several reasons.
We had one trial. Why wasn't all of it wrapped up?
Because
I've been trying to figure out for a couple of weeks why we're going through this after that trial in state court, and I think Judge Wilkinson's kind of hit the nail on the head here.
Because much of the conduct that we've alleged in this federal action occurred late in the state court action. We could not have pled it as a counterclaim because we were after the deadline for filing counterclaims under the rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Well, you can ask for permission to file it out of time, even if you're out of time, if you're before trial.
We could have, but the problem that...
You didn't try to.
Well, we would have been asking the court to allow an amendment for things that occurred right before trial.
Could you have brought it in a timely fashion?
Say that again?
Could you have brought the claim in a timely fashion?
No, because most of it deals with conduct that occurred, again, after the deadline under the rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia for filing a counterclaim. And even under the liberal amendment standards of those rules, which parallel the federal Rule 15, we would not have been able to do it because trying to amend a complaint at the trial for conduct that's occurring at the trial would be highly prejudicial.
I'd like to return to the question that Judge Keenan opened this discussion with, and it's still, even after all this argument, it still concerns me. Given the fact that you brought this suit and proving it's a consumer debt is an element of your claim, you don't want banks knowing everything about somebody's life with respect to these statement of charges. So you brought the suit and you have the burden, and you just did nothing. You just made these conclusory statements, but you just did nothing. And if we say that's sufficient, there was no problem of notice, there was no lack of opportunity, but you did nothing. And if we were to say that this satisfies your burden, then we would simply be eliminating this as an element of the statutory cause of action. And what authority do we have to do that? Because normally, to put an issue into dispute for purposes of going forward, somebody has to do something, like saying, look, I didn't even deduct any of these statement of charges as business expenses on my tax return. You know, presumably if these were business charges, most people would seek some sort of deductibility. But you didn't even say that. It was just nothing.
Your Honor, I would submit that, first of all, the issue of the burden of proof, whether that is on the consumer or on the debt collector, vel non, has not been resolved.
But, it troubles me to put it on the debt collector, because then they're going to turn into Javert and sleuths. And I'd rather the consumer come forward with the information that he or she wishes to divulge than have the debt collector moseying around in all aspects of the consumer's private and personal life. So it seems to me just sensible to put it on the, as a practical matter, to put it on the consumer, but also you are the one that brought the cause of action. And just as a general matter of burden of proof allocation, the person that brings the cause of action has the burden of bringing into dispute or creating some issue of tribal fact as to the elements of the claim. So why wouldn't the burden belong with you?
Your Honor, I see I have 30 seconds. I'll try to answer within that time.
Can you just say yes to that?
No, because even if
proof's on the plaintiff, that's the question, as I understand it. You have the burden of proof to make a prima facie case, and the judge here said you didn't.
Okay.
And you have to convince us that the judge is wrong. You can't, unless you're going to come up with some new law. You're saying that, I think maybe the burden of proof is not on the plaintiff.
I see my time is about expired. May I answer the question?
Sure, you can answer.
Okay. I'm going to assume, for purposes of my answer, that the burden is on the plaintiff. Now, I submit that we satisfied that burden under Hepson. And again, the appellee has not stated that that he wants the court not to follow Hepson, or that we didn't satisfy the burden under Hepson. But I think we did. And if the court is going to adopt the appellee's position, what that's going to do is abolish the principle that a party can use the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act even when the party does not owe the debt. Because there's no way that a party who doesn't owe the debt could ever satisfy the requirement of showing the purposes of charges on the credit card.
But, you know, that's a different case, frankly. This case isn't about identity theft. It's not about mistake or the wrong person or whatever. That hasn't really been, really hasn't been brought into play here. That seems to me to raise, it seems to me to be a very different suit. And I'm not sure you can bring in those kind of speculative horribles into what here seems to be nothing more than a simple failure of proof.
But I submit if you set the bar at the place where the appellee wants to set it.
The magistrate judge set the bar so low, and all he said is you have to do a little bit to explain yourself. Give me some context. Give me some background. Tell me what this is all about. He didn't.
I think we did, because in paragraph 6 of the declaration, it says, my client says, I have reviewed the account statement the defendant has provided for those accounts, and none of the charges made to those accounts could have been for use in any business in which I may have been employed. Then in paragraph 7, it says, I never used any credit card, _any, for any business purpose or for any transaction for the purpose of generating a profit.
So, I understand, but that's just wholly conclusory. At any rate, I think we take your argument, and we appreciate it, and would like to come down and recounsel, move into the next case.